Hi everyone, thank you for joining us this evening. I'm here with lovely Marcia, Sandrine and Diane, and we are going to be talking about The Liminal. It's a book that's been growing very broadly over the last few years, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But firstly, we want to thank Dingle Literary Festival for having us here. There's a fantastic lineup all weekend, so we're thrilled to be part of it. I'm Fia. I better not forget myself. I'm Fia. I'm editing the Liminal. The book is, well, it started as a book about direct provision, but it has grown into something far larger, especially after the, let's say, social media blow up and broader media blow up of race related talk in the international press, but also here in Ireland. And that's kind of what this book has started centering around, is the conversation about race in Ireland and institutionalization, which direct provision is part of. And we're just going to have a small talk about those today, and I hope you enjoy. So, guys, thank you for coming in. It's really strange to have something in person. I'm looking at real people and not a screen. I've had so many Zoom meetings. I know you guys have as well. So thank you for coming, making the time to be here this evening. I mentioned there that this book, it's a collection of essays, and a lot of them come back to race in Ireland and how that is being discussed. And just kind of to start off, I wonder how you guys feel that has grown in the last couple of years specifically, because I feel like that's when, let's say, the broader society has started listening, paying attention. And do you think that has kind of lulled a little bit more recently? Whoever would like to take that at the start.
I'll take the first one. I think over the years, like, within the Black community, or like even with myself, like, I never talked about race because it was always something that, I don't know, like, being a migrant is like just put your head down. That was always what it was. And like, you know, I've started having the conversation more when when I had like my little brothers, because they started like talking about like, oh, like, why am I being treated this way or something like that. So I noticed, I was like, okay, so me and my little sister didn't have those conversations. Now, 12 years apart, my brothers are going through the same thing. So it's something that I really need to speak out about it. And like last year, it was, you know, like, we had the pandemic, and then, like, I always say, like, we experienced two forms of pandemic in Ireland. It was racism and COVID-19, because we're all in the house and we're all watching the video of George Floyd. And the first thing that people kept saying is like, ah, sure, at least it's not here. And that angered me, because I was like, time and time and time again, we've seen it, but again, we've just been so trained to just not talk about it, because again, like, if you say it, you're an ungrateful migrant or anything like that. So I don't know, like, yeah, last year was one of those things where it was like, time is up, you know, you really have to have the conversation. And as I say, it started with just my little brothers, where I was like, it was so important for me to let them know that if they're going through that, like, don't be silent the way me and my little sister would have been. And I noticed the more and more Black people I was talking to, they were in the same boat as me, where again, we were just trained to just be quiet. And that's why even when we did the documentary on silencing Black voices, it was doing that. But yeah, I do think it's definitely died down now, because again, if you're still constantly talking about it, it's like, oh, you're always talking about race, as if race is something that you just experienced once and like, oh yeah, that's fine. So I hate that element of it, where it's like, oh, you're always complaining about something, because I'm like, no, I'm just showing you all the different forms of racism that we continuously experience, because it's not going away. It's not going to go away. But like, the only way it's going to get visible is people, is by people having this conversation. And if that means, yeah, going online 365 days continuously saying it, then that's how we have to do it. And for those that like feel like, oh, it's always gonna happen, it's because they're so privileged that they get to pick a month to do the black box and then move away from it, you know. So it has died down because people just think it's like, okay, we addressed it, we've said that Ireland has racism, let's move on from it. But like, that's a dangerous narrative to have.
I think you made a really key point though about how race is something you experience once. I think for a lot of white people, they do experience it once. Like, you talk about racism, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm being racist. It's like, not really, but like, we are race constantly. Like, people don't understand, like, if you are white, you are just considered normal. It's like, people, if you say, like, the example I remember I use, I think it's in a book called Richard Dyer called White. And he said, like, you know, if I say my friend Jenny, instantly you automatically think of a white person. It's like, not until you race them, like my Asian friend Jenny, my black friend Jenny, do you start seeing them in another way. And yeah, I think I definitely write about it online. I think because people got a lot of information online, and like the way the news media cycles, the social media cycles, is like, what's the next thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So people who definitely don't have the direct experience or it has an impact on them, be like, oh my gosh, this is the beginning, let me build on this. It is like, okay, so this is what's trending this week. The same way, like, I don't know, there's another new thing on TikTok trending, which has nothing to do about race, but it could be about cats or whatever. You know, They take it the same way, and it's like, no, these are real people's lives that you're actually impacting. And it's not something that you can, if you can dip in and out of it, you need to understand very privileged, and it's not about you dipping in and out, it's about you constantly like unlearning and implementing that. Granted, you don't have to be an activist and be on the front lines doing a protest, and I'm not saying that, but like, you know, have those uncomfortable conversations with yourself. Very importantly, it's so important to have that internal dialogue and, you know, reflect on past actions or even like present actions that you're doing and look at how people are responding, but also like immediately the circles that you're around, like, are you having these conversations with your friends? Because the fact of the matter is, if you are a person of colour, we are talking about racism.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're white, I don't think they're definitely not having these conversations, or when they are, it's like,
and it's very like, uncomfortable.
Get over that. Like, not being rude, you have to find a way to get over that discomfort, because that discomfort leads to silence and does lead to, like, you know, racism, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think I'm one of the people who, like, I've always talked about racism for years.
Yeah.
And last year, it was actually a relief to see other people talk about racism. Because for so many years, I was the angry black woman within my community, within the black community. I was the black woman, the black girl who never shuts up about racism. You imagine things, you know, everything is racism to you from the black and the white community. So last year, it was actually a relief to see that. Other people standing up and speaking up about racism, because I think often people think that when you talk about racism, it's a judgment on their morals. It's not. It's simply because it doesn't affect you, you can't see it, because it's not part of your daily life, you don't see the struggles that other people go through. So I think for the first time last year, people actually opened their mind and they realized that actually racism is really violent, and people are not just crazy, people are not just angry black women, people are not just screaming in vain. There is racism happening, and what can we do? But I think, like everything else, you know, it's died down at the moment because, again, it doesn't affect people, it doesn't affect white people, it's not the topical, it's not cool anymore to be anti-racist. And I think that's the problem, because I often tell people that anti-racism work isn't something that you can go and do a three-month course and you're anti-racist. It's not that. You have to challenge yourself every day. It's from the way you think, the way you act, the simple things that you do, because racism to me is a set of rules that benefit certain people and put others at a disadvantage. And you see that everywhere, in schools, on the bus, in the canteen, anywhere you go, you can see a certain set of rules that put white people at an advantage, and anyone else who isn't white, anyone else who isn't the default, like you said, automatically you have to work twice as hard just to be seen and just to be heard. And I think it has to be a collective. We all have to work together to realize that, yes, I might not see racism, but just because it doesn't affect me, but it is happening.
Yeah.
And what can I do as a white person, and all of us, we have to work together, because racism is real and it affects all of us, and we have to continuously put in the work.
And I think during the year, like with the link with racism and COVID, I found that whenever I talk about it, it was people like, oh, do you know what, I have things too, I have things going on, COVID is affecting me as well. And it really showed how naive and just selfish people were, because this was like the first time that, like, yeah, like you were talking about it, but I think just for like, for me, it was the first time that I was talking about it. And I remember getting so frustrated with my friends where they'd be like, oh, but I have things going on too. I was like, I'm not comparing it. It's just that it, do you not understand the magnitude that you're having like a whole national conversation? And like, you know, and we did have that. And like, even when you saw it, when the traveling community would come in to talk about it straight away, they were brushed aside because it's like, oh, give it time for black people now. I'm like, it was just the way people were choosing and picking what anti-racism movements were going to follow.
Yeah.
And people were like, yes, like, I understand that black people need to be human, to be humanized, but like, I don't like travelers. I'm like, you're still racist, like, you know. So it was just that where people just kept being like, well, yeah, I can see you, but I still don't believe in what they go through or anything like that. So like, it did really show the selfish nature, because it's like, as you said, if you're going to be anti-racist, it's towards everyone. You just can't choose and pick who you experience that. And again, like, yes, we all experience the pandemic, but different minority groups and different people experience it differently. And I don't think that's a bad thing to admit. Like, we were all privileged in a sense. Like, even like, I look at it with the access to Wi-Fi, like, I had that, other people didn't. So it's like, we were all there, but yeah, so it just really showed like the naive sense where people felt very attacked when it was a conversation that was happening that did live them out, that was trying to like empower other people, that they thought that like they had to have like the narrative in, which again, like, kind of was counterproductive.
That's the issue with white supremacy, that it's taught that like white people are centered. So like the moment they're not centered, they're a threat, because they are like raised to be like, we are the center of everything. So when someone says, I'm going to talk about racism, and like, you don't experience it, like, well, no, but I experienced something. It's like, no, but it's just not about you at this point. Mm-hmm. It's the same way if we go to a doctor, like, I'm healthy and you're sick. The doctor doesn't need to come and check on me, because I'm not sick, I'm fine, so leave me alone.
Yeah.
Essentially, like, what can I do to help you if you're injured or whatever it is? And I think that's something that white people need to have, again, about saying about the internal dialogue. Like, why did I feel the need to center myself in that conversation when I'm not the, whether you want to say victim or the injured party, or I'm not experiencing this thing? Like, honestly, have that conversation with them. It's probably going to be quite hard for you. And again, I don't want, it's not about making anyone a bad person, but like, it is, I think for you to be aware of that and to still say you want to center yourself, you are being selfish, or you aren't seeing things holistically, and that is part of the problem. You need to find a way to move through that, because that's the only way, like you said, if we're going to come together, people have to understand where they are in society and understand like what's the best thing they're going to aid. And like, you know, it's not the fault of like migrants or people of color to sort of kind of solve racism, in the sense that, you know, if you experience something, like, if you're, like I said, if you're hurt, it's not up to you to like heal yourself. You know, that's why you go and see a doctor or see someone to help you. But like, obviously there's still like a working relationship there. So, but it does have to come from white people making a massive effort to be like, I want to be anti-racist, not just for this current period, but like for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I think, what's it called? The natural response for people in any situation, whether they realize that it's unhelpful or not, is to make them relatable to the situation. But in cases like this, obviously it's not relatable. I'm not going to relate to any of those experiences, you know, no matter what. And I think it's just a general personhood lesson that needs to kind of be learned, is you don't always have to be central to what's going on with other people. And your empathy doesn't have to come from you experiencing things either. And that's something I've definitely learned, and I'm continuing to learn so many different aspects of life, you know. Something doesn't have to affect you directly for you to act like it matters. And that's the thing, is acting as well. It's not just, oh, I feel bad about that thing. It's do the thing then. Mm-hmm. Do the thing to undo the thing.
And I think fear and discomfort are natural part of change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are often scared of feeling the fear and being, you know, being uncomfortable with new topics and new things. But I think until we really sit down with your fear and find out, why am I scared of learning this? Why am I scared of acknowledging that I might do things that are racist? Why am I scared of realizing that some of my actions, the way I speak, might be hurting somebody? until we sit down with those discomfort, we're never going to move forward. And we have to sit down with those discomfort and fear. It's okay to feel the fear.
Yeah.
Listen to people telling you that your actions are harmful and learn of ways to undo that.
Very, very, very good. Let's all hug the fear. Marisha, mm-hmm. you have two pieces in the book. One of them is called White Illusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's very passionate, fueled piece, and I enjoyed reading it very, very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Yes. And the other is about ethnicity,
yes.
nationality, the differences, race, ethnicity, nationality, which people kind of mix up
yeah.
a lot and don't realize that they can be different. And I think a lot here, especially in Ireland, people get quite confused by... because we haven't had the conversations as deeply for as long as, mm-hmm. let's say, they have in America or the UK,
mm-hmm.
I feel like has a little bit longer, at least, than
yeah.
us. So maybe you can give us a little broach into that.
Sure. So, I mean, I can't relate to it from an American aspect, but also you can tell from my accent, I'm from England. And what kind of prompted me to write the piece is both in England and in here. So I only moved to Ireland 4 years ago when I started my degree, but I've lived in London my whole life. I recurrently had the question, where are you from? Asked by strangers, or some of the people I kind of just had just met. And when I would say England or London, there'd always be this like confusion, and then this follow-up question, where are you really from, as if I had lied? And it's like, but I haven't lied, because most people, if you ask where they're from, they're gonna give their nationality. So generally, I talk about it in the essay, but nationality is usually kind of like, I guess kind of where you've grown up, usually like where your first passport's kind of from, the kind of culture that you would probably have been immersed in, like I said, kind of by where you're living. And for me, that is British. So like my nationality is British, I have a British passport. But then if you ask me about my ethnicity, it would be Ghanaian, because that's like where my surname is Ghanaian, or part of it. Like my family ancestry would be traced back there. But for me, it wouldn't be correct if someone asked me where I'm from to say Ghana, because like 3 generations of my family have lived in England. To say Ghanaian, I have to talk about my great-grandparents, it'd be very strange to talk about their experience, because first of all, I never met them, so that'd be really weird to start talking about their lives. But second of all, like, you know, if you ask a white person where they're from, if they say London, Dublin, wherever, there's not really a follow-up question, because it's token, like, you know, it's taken that if you're white, you can be from the West. But when you are a person of colour, when it comes from racism, with people being like, oh, but you really can't be from there, because you're basically, they're saying you're not white, and it's like, but being from a certain country doesn't dictate your race. There's a difference, like, I am black, yes, but like, black people can be from anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way, anyone of any race can be from anywhere in the world. And like I said, it's kind of different. The conversation needs to be around us. People, I think, with a lot of the critical race theory, like, you know, works I've read and media I've consumed, there haven't really been that in-depth discussion about the difference between ethnicity and between, you know, race and nationality. And I think it's something that's actually missing. And for people like me, I think the experience is not the same, but it is a relation with people who are, say, biracial or multiracial. There is a duality within the identity. And for me, I'm not repressing my Ghanaianess, I'm also not going to repress my Britishness, because both of them have formed who I am. Like, you know, growing up with, like, in a household that is influenced by, like, Ghanaian ethnicity, but then living in England, it wasn't like one side dominated more than the other. Like I said, they have fed into my identity, but at the same time, I think if you really want to work towards equality and equity, you have to understand your position in society. So if I were to say I'm Ghanaian, you know, I've got cousins who have lived in Ghana their whole life, never left Ghana. We don't have the same experience. So if they're going to say Ghanaian and I'm going to say Ghanaian, that is very confusing if you're asking about, like I said, where are you from? Because, you know, living there their whole life, never leaving, me living in London, that doesn't make sense. That's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And when people have the confusion, they're like, it's just because they don't... I don't think they've met a lot of people of colour, and they don't know a lot about our backgrounds. And I think even when it's come from people of colour who've actually asked me that question as well, I think what they want to do is like include me in their like Africanness. And it's like, you can still include me, but like don't dictate where I'm from. Because I've had to follow up as well with them, where they're like, oh, but you're not really from, why are you saying London? It's like, because I am from London. Like, maybe for you, you were the first person in your generation, like your family, to leave Africa, which is fine, but it's like, talk to my grandparents then. Don't talk to me, because that's not my experience. And again, I think it just needs to be a broad understanding that people can people get to self-identify, and that's the whole thing with racism. Racism doesn't allow people of colour to self-identify. So like, let people, when they say this is where they're from, this is who they are, let them explore that. But also, if you just meet someone, why do you need to know where they're from? It's kind of weird.
That's really, really weird.
Because like, I've never had it where it's been relevant to the conversation, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that is very strange. And again, that's something that I think the internal dialogue needs to come through. Whether you are a person of colour, whether you are a white person, if you need to know where someone's from in the first 5 seconds of meeting them, stop and ask yourself, why do you need to know that?
The excuse is always, though, that, oh, it's a very Irish thing, but I'm like, I've never had to ask anyone where they're from. Like, I'd probably, like, county, and then once they tell me somewhere, you leave it. So like, yeah, I definitely agree with you. And it always goes to race, because I always find that like, whenever I've been on holidays, like to Spain, and if I'm like, I'm Irish, no one questions me there. It's only in Ireland where I'm like, yeah, you have an issue of me saying it. And I'm like, do you want me to pick out my Irish passport? Again, I'm like, yes, I'm Rondese, but like nationality, I'm Irish. And I'm like, yeah, it's really that frustrating thing where I've never had it. Anyone question me abroad, it's always just in Ireland. And it's always like, if I'm like Carlo, and it's like, oh, the sun shines different there, I'm like, no, it's just
what?
Yeah, I've had someone say that, and I'm like, no, it's still Ireland. And I'm like, I know what you're asking, and I can see them looking over, and I'm like, oh, you meant this. Yeah. So I make them feel uncomfortable, because again, I know it's not a genuine question. And I think that's where it's always really hard when you do meet people to understand whether they're being genuine or not, you know. So it's frustrating, but yeah, no, I definitely understand what you're saying.
Yeah, but also I think I've asked people that question, where are you from? And people have asked me that question, where are you from? And I always say I have three different answers depending on who you are, why are you asking me, and you know, what conversation are we having. But I think sometimes some people ask me, where are you from? And my answer can be, I'm from Congo or I'm from Rwanda, because I'm from both countries. I was born in a country where my parents were not from that country. So really, I don't really know where I'm from on the African continent. But also, I'm from Ireland, because as you said, Ireland has shaped everything that I am. And I think there's beauty in really telling people where you're from in a way, if they don't question you further. For example, if you ask me where am I from, if I tell you I'm from Tala, leave it that way. Mm. Let's talk about Tala. Let's talk about that. But if you ask me, where are you from? I say I'm from Rwanda. Let's leave it that way.
Yes.
Stop questioning it. Because I think the problem isn't where are you from question. The problem is, where are you really from?
Mm.
Yes.
Or like,
sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, I think it's about people self-defining though, because like, if somebody, like, I know some people who would have been born and raised in like, say, England or and from in the West, and they don't identify at all with the West, they just say whichever African country, and like, that's perfectly fine, as long as that's what you want to do. But then also for people, I think like us, who, you know, if we are saying Carlo, we're saying Tyler, we're saying London, whatever, the other stuff does come out. So a prime example, if I've got a friend who's her dad's Nigerian and her mum's Russian, and people, like, because of like the way she looks, like, she, obviously she's biracial, people, when she says she's Russian, people don't believe her. But it's like, and people feel the need to ask that straight away. It's like, I didn't want to have a friend with her. I didn't have to ask anything about her race. It just came out as the friendship developed. Like, you know, I'm going to Russia for the summer to see my mum's family. Okay, cool. I was at my dad's house and we did the same, and you know, he got it from Nigeria. And I was like, okay, cool. So information, that's what he said, it's about intention. If you genuinely are curious about a person, that stuff will come out as the relationship continues. But if you have bad intentions, you need to know it straight away, because in your head, you're basically being like, I need to know how to treat them. And it's like, why do you treat me differently depending on the answer I give?
Mm-hmm.
So again, internal dialogue, sort that out.
Favorite words. And just be honest, you know, if you want to know, why am I black, just ask the question.
Yeah.
Really, let's stop going around, because
it's being polite.
Yeah, a lot of the times though, like once I've answered, like, oh, I'm from Ireland, and like, I'd always get the follow-up, like, how long have you been here? And I'm like, oh, since I was 10, I'm 26 now. I assure you, one of us. I'm like, what? Like, what does that mean? So it takes them a while to understand, okay, so you're black and Irish. But it's that once I tell them, like, the length of how I've been in Ireland, and for them, because it's like, oh, so she's been here primary school, secondary school, I guess she can fit in. And it's like, you know, so that even with that, I'm like, okay, so what's the length that, like, what age is it that you are, like, an Irish person or anything like that? But again, I don't know. I never know if that's out of, like, good intention or anything like that. So it's always really hard to gauge it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is a weird one, because I know it is, in a sense, an Irish thing to ask, what county are you from? Like you were saying, you know, it is a very like, oh, surely I know someone there that knows.
Yeah.
You know, that is also part of it. So it is knowing kind of, I guess, the intent behind your own question, or, you know, what other people's intentions are.
I think it's like kind of what you were saying, like, stop, leave it there. Like, if I say one answer, don't follow, there's no need to follow up.
Yeah.
Like, I've given you the answer straight up. Like, because then, like, nothing gets into, I always flip on them, like, oh, you're accusing me of lying. And then, like, oh, no. It's like, well, I just said London, and you're, like, confused. Saying,
and then you're the angry black woman.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, like, now, I just, like, to be honest, I actually just don't engage with someone who feels me to ask about within 5 seconds of meeting me, because I'm almost going to be like, now, read my essay.
Yeah, yes. Take out the book.
Go buy it. Give me some money, though. Don't give it to Dummy.
Mentioned equity and quality somewhere back in there.
Oh, yes.
And it got me thinking about Diane, your piece, which is centered around choice in direct provision and the lack of choice that is within centres. And the kind of lasting effects that nobody really talks about. Once someone seeking asylum gets their papers, is allowed to integrate into society, there's a massive vacuum. Like, there's just, you know, people are left, and that side of things doesn't really get talked about. Direct provision doesn't get talked about that much. A little more, again, you know, with the surging, when a crisis happens, it surges, but the aftermath does not at all. And you know, your piece closes the book because it leaves that opening, you know, and it's one of the first pieces that got added to the book. And like, I'm so grateful that you wrote it, because it's a lot. But you know, you do mention in it the difference between equality and equity, and I think that is something that most people don't understand. You know, we want equality, yes, but you know, how do you get equality when we're not starting in the same place? And you know, you put it far more eloquently than I do. So I would love you to to, you know, just kind of expand on even what that is, because you know, some of our audience might not know.
Yeah, I think definitely when people are in the right provision, in a way, they are the same, because you wake up, you have your breakfast, you have your lunch. You get your toilet paper, your baby gets your formula. Basically, you are all treated in an inhumane way, but equally, you're all the same. But when you get your papers after waiting for many, many years, you leave our provision, and suddenly, you're not the same. You used to wake up, go have breakfast, go for lunch, be idle for however many hours. But once you leave that system, you realize that actually, we're not all equal up there. But no one ever told you that. I've met people who genuinely don't know how to use a washing machine properly, because where they came from, they've never had a washing machine. Mm. In their upper vision, they only had one set of washing machine, never changes. And when they get their own houses, it's different. They have no clue how to use it. They have no clue how to dry their clothes, because maybe they live in an apartment. So for me, I think we focus a lot more on equality, and I think it's a very unfair system to focus on, because although everyone is in their upper vision, they all have different needs. And when they leave, they've never been prepared for the outside world. I've worked with homeless people. I've worked with, I'm a social worker working with children. I've worked with loads of, within different institutions, and the provision is the only institution where we never prepare people leaving that institution. Mm-hmm. When I'm working with children, when they're 17, I have to have a plan in place of how are they going to navigate the outside world. I need to have the plan. about 100 pages. I have to present that to a judge. They have to read it and, you know, give it a go ahead. I've worked with homeless people. The same. You need to have a plan for when they leave the system. But the Reprovision is the only system where we never prepare people to get out of that system. And it's very, very unfair because the outside world isn't equal. They leave that Reprovision system, they're faced with racism, they're faced with classism, they're faced with gender issues, they're faced with so many isms that they've never been prepared for. Mm-hmm. So I think the goal should yes, equality is great, but equity should be the goal, because equity means you give people what they need. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have one leg and you come in saying, oh, everyone is getting a chair, but my leg doesn't work for that chair. I need a crutch, I don't need a chair, if that makes sense. So I don't know, or maybe I come in and I'm hungry. Or you wanna give everyone a book. I don't need a book, I want food. You know? So the goal should always be equity. You know, although everyone's seeking asylum, they're all looking for shelter, they're all looking for refuge, that's great. But we need to have some sort of a system. We need to have humanity in how we approach and how we deal with people seeking asylum, because not everyone has the same needs. They all have different needs. And you lock them up for 5, 10 years, you let them go into the outside, the big world, and they have no clue how to manage or navigate anything. Because in that system that we locked them in, they were all equal. But when they leave, they realize, actually, I have different needs that no one ever told me that I needed to prepare for. So I think we need to focus on equity, especially for people seeking asylum, especially for people who are traumatized and need help.
Absolutely. I think I remember there's a woman called Lisa Sharon Harper, she's like a critical race theorist. She spoke about that and like how equity is about access to resources. And like you kind of saying exactly what you were saying, you know, it's all well and good for everyone to be equal, but like if I can access, like what you were kind of look at a pandemic, like who got the vaccines first? People in the West, like even now, they're looking up statistics, and it's like there are like Asian African countries where, like, well, particularly in African countries, I've seen that like some, like in the whole population, maybe only like 4% is vaccinated. And it's like, look at the West. What percentages are we on, you know? And, you know, who was selling the vaccines to whom? And, like, these are all the things about access and, like, about equity that needs to be discussed. And because it's not, you know, surprising that within the West, most of the resources are kind of hoarded there. But then even, like, kind of like what you were saying, depending on where you are in the West, like, we can access if, like, you know, everyone's got access to Wi-Fi, everyone's got access to the vaccine. It's like, well, no, if you're in direct provision, you know, you may not have those things, or odds are you probably don't. Or you don't even have to be in direct provision. You just could be walking around the streets of Dublin and, you know, never, like, people could be homeless, people don't have Wi-Fi, people don't have access to a doctor. And I think if the conversation's really going to be moved forward, like you said, there needs to be a plan in place. How are we all going to access these resources and make sure that we always can, because the resources aren't finite, like, despite what people say. Everyone does can have access to them and should have access to the basic human right.
One thing people, societies in general do is like they box people in nice, neat little categories, you know, and they'll say, okay, these are the asylum seekers. Mm. These are the people in X class and Y class, and therefore they all need this pocket of you know, resources, this pocket of resources, without actually looking at what the individuals within those XYZ sections need. And then it's just, there's never any actual equality in the end. Or equity, definitely, that's just, that doesn't exist. But those boxes, you know, we're on to the othering. We're on to the othering. You know, actually, one of the first things I had thought about writing about for this book was othering, because it was, I became aware of it through classics and post-colonial studies. And Edward Said obviously came up with, you know, Orientalism, this whole concept of what the other is. and how that, you know, categorizes people in a really unhelpful, to put it nicely, way. And that is what happens in the case of direct provision. You know, they with the capital T kind of type stuff. They need this, they need that. That will be good, that will be, you know, bad for them, whatever. Without active kind of, what's it called? Without looking into the reality, it lets people skim over what's real and what the individual is and needs. And you kind of mentioned moving forward from like the, with the concept of otherizing, you know, it's the inner dialogue thing again, just having it kind of constantly, having that awareness there. Do you think people are ready for doing that in Ireland? Like, well, how can we get people to a place where they realize that they are othering in an unhelpful way?
Yeah, I don't know. I think with othering, I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about. So like in the essay, I wrote it like in both direct provision, but then also when you have a dual identity where in that regard, you have to choose one or the other, because, you know, with that example I gave you, when I tell someone how long I've been in Ireland, it's like, oh, you're one of us. But before I say that, I was a they. So, you know, it's a very, it happens all the time in Ireland. So I think it's going to be, I don't know if we'll ever be able to get rid of it, because it's just in the different conversations that you'd have. So like, even like, I tutor sociology, and we've been doing it on something like the pandemic, being like, okay, we were all affected by it, but different marginalized community got it. And it's like, well, they did this. And so it's even with young people, and they don't understand the magnitude of the word they. They don't, you don't have to do post-colonial to understand it. Like, it's such a habit, and it's been so instilled into like society, where it's just an us versus them mentality. Where like, even when you're given the example with the vaccine, yeah, it is like protect our own. So until we get to a place in Ireland where, first of all, people recognize racism, and how through that, by categorizing people into us versus them, is racist. Because you're, again, like, I'd written about this, like in regards to the 2004 referendum, you know, when black women were accused of being like the ones to come here and just pop out babies to be Irish. Like, that was a they them straight away. Do you know, and you still have that now, where I've seen it where people are talking about racism, and it's like, well, if they didn't do this, then they wouldn't have, like, we'll still need to talk about it, do you know? So it's just a part of our vocab. And the only way to do that is by, again, understanding the power of language. And people don't understand that, because for them, it's just that protecting our own, and it goes back to, like, that outdated version of what Irishness look like, and it's only white, so you're only going to protect someone that's white, because, and that's why you don't, they don't see even there, like, you don't see why direct provision is racist, because again, like, if it was all majority white, oh, you'd see it, but because it's not, it's very easy to be like, well, they shouldn't come here, they shouldn't, and I'm like, this is a country of migration, like, how, it's such a hypocritical thing. So we, like, you know, like, in Ireland, we have been considered, like, the blacks of Europe, so they have been on the other side of the they versus, like, us versus them mentality, like, in the UK and the US, and then, like, by establishing that really, like, white national, like, identity, has just instilled that sense of us versus them, that I can't see it going away until we have the discussion of how, like, Irishness is changing, and how you can't be protecting your own and it just being white, like.
Also not allowing, like, they to, like, be a sign of deflection. Because I think an example like that, but also even when you do try to talk about racism or race in Ireland, instantly they're like, oh, but it's not as bad as the UK, it's not as bad as America. Like, we don't have to be talking about America and the UK. Like, I always say, if someone's scale of 1 to 10, if America's a 10, UK's a 9.9, you're sitting on an 8. 8 is not a good number to be on. Like, so don't act as if an 8 is a great number. So, and it's not about that. It's like about, okay, if you're saying protect our own, what is going on in our own country that we need to solve? There should be that reflection, that, you know, urge to to do something. And I think when we are talking about, and you've tried to include the they, you know, when they's are being othered, it should be like we're saying, if we are having that collaborative effort, everyone needs to come together. It doesn't mean that we leave the migrants to the side, or we leave people of colour to the side and say, oh, but we're not doing anything, or we're not as bad as this place. It's like, no, let's all come together. We need to, there's a problem, we all need to have to fix it. So how are we going to do that? And again, that deflecting thing, I think, comes from the centering. Like, oh, how can I feel better? Oh, if I make them a they thing, it's my problem, I didn't do anything. And it's like, no. Like, again, why do you need to push them at a distance? Like, what is that saying about you?
But I think there's like a comfort with having a they in Ireland, like that other, because again, as you say, like when George Floyd happened, that was the first thing where it was like, don't complain about it because you'll never experience that. And I'm like, but it's still racism. Like, what, like, who gives you the right to like determine what trauma black people get to experience in Ireland versus England versus that? Because I'm like, we're still experiencing it. So do you know what, like, I even found myself like where I was doing talks, I was like, oh yeah, this is not as bad. I'm like, who hurt me to like to say that? Because I'm like, I've still experienced it. But then again, even then, I've been trained to not complain, because in Ireland I can walk past the Gardaí and not feel that fear, you know. So I've been trained to be like, I should be thankful that. So like, there, until that's gone, until like we have that discussion, to like, why do we need another? Why do we need that person that we can always compare to, like America and that? And we can't really step away from this conversation, because as I say, like, racism is steeped in every aspect of society in Ireland. And anyone who doesn't, and anyone who says it isn't, then you haven't lived a day as a marginalized community, where every little thing you do, it's like you have to be so careful around what you're doing, and like that hyper awareness, and it's so exhausting, so it's so tiring in that regard. So like, when it does come to people which again are trying to tell you like, at least you're not experiencing as bad, I'm like, oh yeah, thank you so much, I need, no you don't, like, it just becomes more and more frustrating. And that again is just, I don't know, it angers me, because like in Ireland we're in such a unique position, because like I did history, and like in any of the things I write, like I trace back like the Irish treatment. I'm like, we've had this for so long, we were colonized, we were caught, like, you know, like there were signs like no blacks, no dogs, no Irish, and like you still can't empathize with people here. Like, I don't know, there's no words to it, like, where again, it just, we really just need to move past that and have these uncomfortable conversations, because if they're uncomfortable for you as a white person, imagine what their life or like the other person sitting there having to tell you this. Because again, that's always a thing, that whenever you're meeting new people, it's like, how soon do I tell them this? How soon do I tell them that that makes me feel uncomfortable? Because as you were saying earlier, like, you just fall into that trap of always being that angry black woman, but then if you don't say anything, like, then that's internalized racism you're having, do you know, anything like that. So this vicious circle of us versus them.
And I think it's us dividing each other into them and us has been part of human life since the cave age. But I think, as you said, that we need to decide, how long do I have to stay in Ireland for me not to be an immigrant anymore, for me to actually be one of you? When is that going to happen? Do you know, is it my mother's generation? Is it my grandmother's generation? Is it my grandchildren's generation? Mm. Are black people always going to be seen as others and as immigrants? Or is there going to be a time in history where we'll be part of Ireland? Because I think the them and us, that's just survival, is always going to be there. But I think we need, as an Irish society, realize that black people are here to stay. We're not going anywhere. So we just have to find a way to remember that we're here. We're not them anymore. We are us. We are Irish, and we're not going anywhere.
But for me, it's always like, diversity is such a beautiful thing. Like, I get so excited when I meet people and they're like, oh, my mom is from here and I'm from here, and like, I ended up in Ireland. Like, it's the most randomest thing. Do you know? So like, I even look at it like, you know, like, I've been from Rwanda, like my boyfriend was adopted from Romania into Ireland. Like, even just the probability of that, like, do you know? So it's like, why fear that? Like, that should just be like the most beautiful thing, because like, when you are doing that family bloodline, like, do you know, you'd be able to just trace it everywhere. So like, for people who fear that, I'm like, it's gonna happen either way. Like, you can't change people like with that, but like, it should just be seen as something beautiful and something like on the, like, moving forward. Because again, like, with my little brothers, like, their classroom was so diverse. Like, I think, like, it's so cool that they're not the only black people in a class anymore. Like, that was so traumatizing for me. So for them being like, oh yeah, like, my friend from Syria, my friend from here, like, that's how it should be, and that's what Ireland should be, and with Celtic Tiger, like, it's it was always going to be like that. So it's like, we just have to move on from it, and, like, really just accept that, like, it is moving forward, and it is going to be, like, multicultural, and, like, in furious time, like, yeah, you just will not be able to get away with, like, asking a black person, like, where are you really from? Because they would be born in Cairo, didn't they? Yeah. So you just have to deal with it.
Also, yeah. I think as well, like, a lot of people don't realise, like, how many things they like that come from, like, Asian cultures or black cultures or from, like, Latin American cultures. Like, for example, like, Fia and I were both, like, mad into K-pop. It's like, but I'm not gonna, like, I can't say I love K-pop, and then if I see an Asian person not accept them for mine, like, it doesn't make sense. You can't love their cultures but not love the people. Yeah. That's what I was saying. Like, that's the thing, like, what you're saying about, like, the beauty and diversity. Like, I've had people say to me, like, with the whole where are you really from question, oh, you know, just when I was growing up, I didn't have people from different places. It's like, okay, that's genuinely how you feel. You need to embrace it on all fronts. Like, embrace us for everything, but then also listen to us when we're, like, advocating for ourselves and defining ourselves. We're saying it's not it's a boundary. You need to respect that boundary, because, like, when you're not respecting that boundary, that is when you are othering me, because the people who you see as the us, you respect their boundaries. Mm. So you need to respect mine too. And, like I said, if you're going to love the cultures, which are great, you need to love the people as well. You can't pick one over the other.
Mm-hmm. And I think difference is beautiful, you know? Like, that's why when people ask me where am I from, sometimes I'm happy to tell you where I'm from, because I want you to learn where I'm from, because, as I said, we're not going anywhere. And imagine in, like, 50 years, there'll be lots of black Irish people. Mm-hmm. And that difference needs to be celebrated, from children up to, you know, grown-ups. And diversity, yeah, it's good. But diversity is good, yeah, but there's no point of diversity if you're not putting any systems in place to ensure that diversity is working.
Yes.
So we need to celebrate it, yes, but also ensure that it's working for everyone.
So that's all we have time for, actually. It was so great to have virtual audience. Thank you for watching. But especially you guys, thank you for coming in. Really enjoyed this. And there's so much more we could talk about. I mean, I feel like we could have hours and hours of conversations about so many things. But I'm glad we got to cover what we did. There's hopefully going to be more scope for that. I know there's a chat on the Sunday of the festival that will also hopefully cover some of this and much more. But yeah, I need to also thank the Goddard Bookshop here in Dublin for letting us film here. It's been very nice. And I hope you all enjoy the festival.